Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin. No Gary Spain this week because we have something very special for you. We have an interview with League of Ireland winner and former Republic of Ireland manager Owen Hand, so stick with us for that. Remember, you can listen to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, YouTube and Amazon Music, as well as a host of other platforms too. Share the show on your social media platforms to help others learn about the history and heritage of Irish football. Now, my guest on this week's show has had an incredible footballing life, both as player and manager. Played over 260 matches with Portsmouth. He's won the League of Ireland and the FAI Cup with Limerick, managed his country, being Republic of Ireland boss from 1980 to 85. He managed Huddersfield Town for four seasons, as well as playing in and managing teams in South Africa and managing out in Saudi Arabia as well. I'm delighted to have Owen Hand with us on the show. Owen, you're very welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be on it. It is indeed.
If we start off by maybe going all the way back to the start for yourself, where does your love of football begin, you know, in your is it early childhood or?
Well, yes, indeed. As far as I can, I mean, as soon as I was kind of in Drumcondra, I was right in Drumcondra there, not too far from Croke Park, but the habits for young lads then was to play on the roads because there was no traffic, was very, very slow. So, I mean, playing football on the road, you had to learn control a ball because the bounces were, it could hit a lamppost, it could hit a curb, it could hit anything. So it would come at you very, so it was a really good learn. Looking back, it was a really good learning curve. And then when you got on grass, which we did, there was a park called Griffith Park in Drumcondra. And that was a big, big pleasure for us to go down to that and play on grass. But basically, I'm talking about now when I was kind of, say 8, 9, 10. And then when football got organised, like so Stella Maris was the local club for me. Stella Maris was, say, I think it was under 13 was the first organised team that I played for. But I was only, as I recall, I was only a 10-year-old. And because I was, and they used me seemingly because I was pretty okay for that age, that I could cope with being playing with the under 13s. So that now at the same time I was being educated in O'Connell School, and the Christian Brothers had a great reputation for hating foreign games, so that didn't help me at all. There was one particular brother called Brother Curtin. His nickname was the Bull, and well nicknamed, and he used to actually single me out to a point where it became nasty stuff, where he singled me out for not doing my exercises right or whatever, and he'd pick on some little tiny little part that was bad in it and all that, and then he'd give me a hiding, physical, you know, which was, I mean, that's the way it was. My father had gone to England to work. I never knew my father. He died over there when I was 10, so I never knew him. But my mother was, as were an awful lot of Irish mothers then, a wonderful, wonderful worker. I mean, she went out to work to raise four boys, me being the youngest. And she came down and she had a go at the brother Curtin. I'll never forget it. And she says, "How dare you? If you ever do that again," she said, you're going to really get into trouble with me," or whatever. So that helped. So, I mean, this all gave me, I mean, relative to me being a footballer, it gave me the drive to want to be when I had my mother getting into trouble for helping me to be a footballer. And I had this brother Curtin who inadvertently didn't know that he was a real motivating factor for me, which he was. And he kind of gave me the drive to say, "Well, right, do you think you're going to stop me playing football, playing soccer, that is, as we called it then. Football was the whole game about GAA and all that. But so, I mean, I made it very, very clear that I was going to be playing with Stella Maris, and I did, and I enjoyed it there. I enjoyed my time there, and to a point where I was then, say, leaving certificate coming up to, which is obviously teen, but way before that, I had a trial with Swindon, going over in the summer, and I think this was about, oh gosh, I was only about 17 or something like that. And they were very impressed with me as a winger. I was a winger then, because I'd grown up and they saw good skill and also I had good pace. So they took me on and they didn't take me on then. It was just after when I finished school that they were waiting, but they couldn't because my mother insisted that I do my leaving cert, which was a great thing, really, looking back, to have education finished. So playing football, getting back to the football thing, it was difficult in those days because there were so many things stopping you and against you, which, unless you did, it gave me a drive. So it worked in reverse, that if this hadn't happened, perhaps I wouldn't have had the drive to be a footballer. And anyway, Swindon Town took me, when I finished the leaving cert, they took me for one season. And I went over there as an 18-year-old, and as a winger. And in fact, the winger on the first team was a man called Mike Sorby, who went on to be a real top player, was transferred from Swindon to Manchester City. Yeah. And I followed his career all the way through. And of course then, to me, it was just, he was my idol, he was this and that. But there was one occasion then, I think, when the centre-backs were all injured and whatever, and they tried me out at centre-back, and seemingly, I thought this is easy to play here. Anyway, they let me go, as it happens, and then I came back, and I was just around Drumcondra, I'd done my leaving cert. What am I going to do with my legs now apart from that? I approached car sales, which I hadn't got a clue about, but I had to do something. So car sales, and then I was playing with Stella Maris. The switch over from centre, from being a forward to being a centre back, that was, I think, really, do I go back to, I'm not quite sure about memory-wise, but when it actually, which club it was that actually moved me. I think it was, I know when I went to Limerick, I went there as a winger, and in that situation with Limerick, it was a strange situation coming back from Swindon, because I was such a young man. I was only 18 and a half, 19. And here I was. I had actually been dumped by Swindon because they were relegated. And all the younger players were let go. They basically couldn't afford to give them the opportunity to stay on, which was a big blow. Mm. So anyway, that was it. Back to Swindon. And it was back to Limerick. And that's where really, I suppose, my footballing days really helped in a big way, because Mickey Webb was the manager of Limerick, was the chairman of Limerick then. And it was very interesting times, in so much as that, me playing as a winger with Limerick, I did very, very well with them. And I remember scoring four goals against, it was a Donegal team or something, Finn Harps, I think it might be. And we won 4-1, and I scored all four goals. So
nice.
It has given me a good lift and whatever, a good, all this kind of messy start to my, shall I say, desire to be a professional footballer, which it was. But now it was leveling out, and I was getting the rewards back that my desire had overcome. All the different times that I was disappointed and let down. My mother couldn't do anything about it because, she, a woman in those days, didn't interfere with sport, like, as such. But so that was the beginning of my footballing career, type of thing. So,
and that experience of kind of, because you kind of mentioned it in what you were saying there, that experience of kind of people telling you you can't do this or you shouldn't do this, is that something that you brought with you for the rest of your career as well? As in, the more people told you maybe that you weren't good enough or that you couldn't do this, that you actually said, you know what, I'm going to prove you wrong. And I suppose that was kind of the basis for developing that career as well.
I would, definitely agree that that was the case. All those knockbacks all gave me a drive throughout my career. You got it spot on. Throughout my career, whenever there was a problem that came up that said, oh my God, this is not going to be a help at all, I said, no, hold on a second. What is the problem? Is it the problem, this manager, this coach that I'm under? How do I deal with it? And I was always kind of conscious of there is a way to deal with it. And you've just got to put your mind to it. And so all that, shall we say, that learning curve through the early days was a big help in that way, exactly as you just pointed out there.
Great.
And it was very, very evident. And I was conscious of that throughout my career, throughout my managerial career, when I stopped playing even. I mean, I always said, right, that is the way to go about it. There's a big problem about it, but how do we overcome the problem? Mm. So,
and in doing so, you kind of had short spells with Dundalk and Shelburne, but it's really Drumcondra is the rocket that really gives your career the lift. Talk to us a little bit about Drumcondra as well, obviously the area in which you grew up, because at the time we don't see it now, obviously, because it's faded away as a club, but Drumcondra was a very successful League of Ireland football club in its own right at the time, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was run by the Proles, P-R-O-L-E. Mm. And they had a reputation for being very mean and very tight with money, and which they were, because, I mean, when I played with them, and they switched me actually from winger. That's what I did. They switched me from winger to centre-back, regular. Centre-back or, say, midfielder holding. And then, because I was then first-team regular, contract time came, and they said, oh, well, we can give you, I think it was 10 shillings raise. And I went from £4 to £4, 10 shillings or something like that, which was kind of, oh my God, you know, secret. I mean, okay, those days, £4 is a lot of money. Mm. It was for me anyway. But they were pretty mean. They really were mean. So when the opportunity came for them to sell me, which they sold me for 7,500, which was, you can imagine it was a fortune. It was a fortune then. And they sold me to Portsmouth, you know, so, and that was a real, shall we say, crossroads in my career to go over to Portsmouth, where I didn't know the standard at all. I mean, Portsmouth were second division then, but, I remember making my debut against Queen's Park Rangers. I'm thinking, as a centre-back now, this is a centre-back, and thinking, you know, they've paid 7,500 for me, so I better be up, step up to the mark, like whatever. Anyway, but no, it wasn't really. I was going to do it. I was so determined to do well. QPR was a big test. And I went about it and said, okay, they know that I'm a rookie, so they'll be putting pressure on me. And they were. I think there was a fellow called Marsh now. I think it was Rodney Marsh was his name. And he was a very big name there. I think he actually might have been had to do caps for England.
That's right, yeah.
But anyway, he took me on and... come on, Paddy. And he was teasing me. And he actually gave me the drive that he finished up, that he did never got a kick at the ball. I totally outplayed him. And we got a draw, I think. I think we got a 0-0 draw. So that was a huge eye-opener for me to say, you know, you can do it. You can stand the pace over here, because I got pace because of me being, say, a wide player, a winger, as against, say, me being a centre-back or defensive midfielder. Now, that's exactly, you know, how it worked out. And it was those, that game particularly gave me a huge boost, the Rodney Marsh one. And I went on from there. And then, of course, there was the international scene came as a player.
Just at that time as well, did you feel like your performances were good enough to play for Ireland, or did the call to play for Ireland kind of come out of the blue? Was it something that you expected might happen but weren't sure if it would, or was it out of the blue?
No, it was a might happen situation. Mm. Because I was in England, certainly it was just, you know, wouldn't it be such a lift if I was to be capped for Ireland? But it was never ever expected. I mean, it's one thing playing club football, but playing international football, oh wow. So it came out of the blue when I was picked to go on a trip somewhere out Turkey way. Yeah. And anyway, I did play for Ireland as centre back, and I really took to it, and I showed that okay, I was nervous, sure I was, but I got through the game, and I think we got a draw out of that game, and I played pretty well, so I was quite happy with my career, shall we say. I mean, you know, here I am. What age? I'm not quite sure what age I was when this all happened. Looking back, I mean, it's what, the late 70s, early 80s. Mm. I know Limerick was early 80s. So that was kind of at the end of my career. So this is early 70s or something like that.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I used the fact that my brother had gone to my brother that I was very close to, Eamon, sadly he's passed away. He'd educated himself and he became an architect. And he went out to, he lived in Durban in South Africa. So I used the fact that South Africa was taking players for summer, for the off-season in English game. And they would say that they would pay their wages. So, for instance, so the English club didn't have to pay the wages to that player. So they said, okay. And then he'd come back. So, but you're still the English club's player. So I did that a couple of years, mainly to go and visit my brother, who I missed. In those days, I mean, you just didn't hop on a plane and go to places like South Africa. So to go out there and to be a guest player and be in they'd put me up in a hotel. And not a five-star hotel, but it was adequate, whatever. And that was a good way of me enjoying South Africa. And, of course, then that was to have a huge influence later on about, you know, my football days.
Mm. Talk to me a little bit about, because you mentioned that you'd come back to South Africa again later in your footballing career, but you played at Port Elizabeth, Lusitano in 75, Arcadia in 76, back to Lusitano in 77 as well. So this connection with South Africa would kind of pop up again. But what was football like in South Africa at that time as well, in the kind of, the mid-70s?
Well, the clubs I played for, they were, I think, for instance, now Arcadia, I think they were the first ones that, say, dealt with the apartheid situation. Hmm. And they were the first club to have what was called, you know, a player from the black area, shall we say. And I think his name was Vincent Julius. And I was proud to be the captain of that club and to be the first club in South Africa to play without legally, you know, without any arguments about it, just put it down as a normal player. Mm. Instead of this whole big deal of trying making a player, oh, we're in apartheid Africa now, we can't do that, but we'll take a chance. No, I suggested to our manager or coach or whatever, I said, just if you're going to, just don't say anything, just play him. And that's what happened. And I was proud of the fact of my part in that, because it was a big, big thing at the time about, you know, playing, you know, a white club, having, say, a coloured player in the dressing room and in the showers and all that kind of ridiculous. But that's the way it was. So I was proud of the fact that of the part I played in doing away with that in sport, certainly in my sport. And I would imagine that I would be acknowledged in the soccer world in Africa for that.
And what was the response to that from, I suppose, your own fans or even in the dressing room with your own kind of players?
Look, when we saw that Vincent Julius was, you know, and the lads met him or whatever, my directors and what I said, you know, he can't be in the dressing room with you. I said, what do you mean he can't be in the dressing room? He has to be in the dressing room. Well, he'll have to be, you know, quick and out. And I said, no, he will just be ordinary and be treated ordinary. And I got all the players and I had a meeting with them, just unbeknown to the directors and whatever. And I said, listen, guys, it could be that we're going to be threatening to go on strike because we're not going to take that. And we did. And we had our way. And, of course, then the big thing was at the end of the season, any coloured player or any coloured person wasn't allowed into the ball, you know, the dancing part of it. And I said, no, hold on a second. If you think that we're going to have an end of season dinner where you're going to be presenting the player of the season, perhaps with a trophy, and that person could easily be Vincent Julius. Now, how the hell are you going to do that if you're saying now that you can't invite him? And they gave in. So that's another part where I'm proud of the way I went about it anyway, all that kind of thing. That I don't know if it was acknowledged or, I mean, officially acknowledged now, but that is the truth of the matter. And there are players of that era, whoever's still alive, would bear that out. So I am proud of the way I went about that whole situation because it was a very awkward one, very, very awkward.
Yeah, and I imagine at the time as well, the press and the media within South Africa probably had their pound of flesh on it too, which probably made the situation a little bit uncomfortable. But again, is it kind of going back to that thing like we mentioned earlier, which was somebody said, actually, sorry, you can't do this. You're not allowed to do this. And you dug your heels in and were like, actually, no, this is what we're doing.
Exactly. That's, yeah, following on what you said earlier on about things that happened to me in my career where I was given I had to climb a hill to get something done, whatever. Well, that great example was that particular incident, you know, with Vincent Julius. So I'm proud of that fact and whatever.
And indeed, I suppose that the other side of that too is Vincent Julius was climbing his own hill too, was he not, with that situation?
Oh yeah, very much so. Very much so. He knew that he was going to get stuff like, you know, certainly away games was going to be a problem. The home games, we were kind of educating our home crowd and which worked. And there was always the odd yabos with drink on. You know, they'd say, hey, you blackie, okay, all that kind of stuff. But very seldom. But away from home, Vincent was very much aware of. And he would just ignore them. And that was the best way to do it. Because if everybody ignored these bookers, and it was, the change was coming about. I mean, it really was in rugby as well and in cricket and whatever. All sports were getting a little bit wiser. And there was more pressure coming on globally from, you know, John Robbie was a famous rugby player. He played for Ireland. John Robbie was a good friend of mine out there. I became very friendly with him. And he knew what I was doing and he was totally for it. And he actually had a radio show and he had me on it. And he was backing me, and that helped a hell of a lot. John Robbie's sports show, that was in Johannesburg. And we used that as well to supplement all the other stuff and whatever, because we knew that it was the right thing to do. And we knew that eventually it was all going to come right, that apartheid wouldn't have any effect on sport, which it shouldn't have. So anyway, and it worked.
Yeah, fantastic. And from then there to, am I right in saying back to Shamrock Rovers for a short spell and then on to Portsmouth again?
That's right, yeah. Shamrock Rovers under John Giles came back and I think he was short centre back come midfield player, whatever. And I played, I think, about 8 or 9 games for John. And then I hadn't got any, I had a house, I'd bought a house in Portsmouth I had got married in 1969. So John and my wife were still in England, kind of in the house in Portsmouth. The South African thing was all she came out there, visited for a short visit, and always went back. It was very kind of mixed up, kind of. But, you know, as well as that, I mean, I think my son was born, Gary, who is now captain with British Airways. Nice. So, it's been very, very interesting.
You had short spells with Shamrock Rovers, and you mentioned Johnny Giles there as well. We were talking about Johnny Giles on a previous podcast, and I suppose his talent and how good he was, etc. In terms of his managerial style, you had a brief spell under him, but what was it like working with Johnny, and what was his kind of, I suppose, his managerial ethos? What was he trying to get the best out of you, and how was he trying to do it?
Well, John was brilliant. He was such an intelligent guy. I mean, and like football, as a football manager and coach, as a player, he was brilliant. I mean, his vision on the football field, he saw everything. If you gave it to him, say, I'm playing for Ireland, say, when I played for Ireland, I would say played midfield. If you gave it to John Giles, that was it. That's all you had to do. If you won the ball, and that's when John was manager, he used me in that situation, just because I'd win the ball, I'd give it to those who could play. In other words, I mean, that wouldn't be me. And using that to could play, i.e. would be creative as midfield players, to have the vision to say, okay, I'm going to switch this from right to left, blah, 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 which now is just not taken as part of the game. But then it was revolutionary type of thing to have players who would have the vision for that. So John was brilliant. He was way ahead of his time, really. I mean, he was well known. Worldwide, he was starting to get a reputation as well. Like, I mean, I can remember, like, I mean, we went to play Brazil and whatever, and the likes of Pele and all these people, you know, John Giles was rated so highly and whatever, you know. So he was our first world-class player. And to this day, I still think that's the case. He was our first ever world-class player. So it was great to meet him recently there in December in Clontarf Castle, when all those players of the 74 team had an assembly thing there. But no, John was one that you could absolutely listen to, and his diagnosis and his speaking about a game was amazing. I mean, he would say things, you say, my God, yeah, he's right. And he was never wrong. I mean, if he was wrong, he would say, yeah, I got that one wrong. And the reason I got it wrong is this. So he'd have a reason for that now. So he was magnificent, absolutely magnificent.
And what was his management style like? What did was he a kind of, was he a man manager? Was he a tactician? What kind of managerial kind of skills did he bring to the table, do you think?
John was just, he used common sense. I think he really was. He says, he would say, listen, if you're not doing something right, I'll know that you're not doing something right. And I'll explain to you. And I'll ask you, this is the way I want you to do it. So he was a very, very commonsensical manager. Like, he wasn't a bully or anything like that. He wanted you to understand exactly what was needed from you. And if you made a mistake, he would then point it out and say, listen, you did that wrong. So, I mean, to me, he was certainly educational for me. Whenever through my career as a manager, I would look back and I would think John Giles would do it this way. I mean, that is a big compliment I am paying him. Okay, I mean, it was certainly, you had your own decisions to make at times, and you had to make them by yourself. But generally speaking, John was a great example, not just for me, but for anybody. He never lost his cool. Never. I never see him lose his cool. About anything, whether it be a bus not turning up, or coach not turning up in time to collect the players or anything like that, John would just go quietly and have a word with him. And the word would be, that can't happen again, or else we won't be using you, type of thing. So he'd make it very effective. And it'd be the right thing to do. He just would be so strong on it. The right thing. He was always highly principled about what he did and what he said. So as that when he said something, it was very hard to contradict it. And if you did not understand it and you asked him,
he'd give you a full explanation, and you'd say, yeah, gosh, that made sense. So I've got an awful lot of time for John Giles as a person and as a manager, and I really have. And a huge influence on me throughout my career.
Mm. And indeed, I suspect you brought that influence with you in 1979 when you took over at Limerick United. First of all, talk to us about how that came about. How did you end up there, and I suppose as player manager?
Well, I had big decisions to make. I mean, I had big decisions to make in so much as that what I was going to do. I think, of course, it was coming to the end of its reign for me. I had been going backwards and forwards out to South Africa. Mm. I wanted to now maybe just stabilize and say, hold on a second, where do I come from? I come from Ireland. So I think I then said to myself, it's time I kind of made a move to Ireland. And as it happens, luck would have it that I had no connections with Limerick at all. Dublin was my scene. But Limerick were going, making big moves to get a full-time manager. And I let through the media, I think it must have been through the media, I known that I was in the market type of thing for a position. I had been offered a job. I remember I was offered jobs out in Korea, places like that. And I thought, oh, I don't need that. A really good, you know, good money and all that. No, so I choose Limerick. I had Mickey Webb came over to Heathrow Airport, I think it was, and to meet him. I had a house in Portsmouth. So I came and I met with him, and we discussed what he had at Limerick at the time and what he wanted and whatever. And I agreed, because this was just a general thing. I agreed to come and have further talks, and that's what I did. The markets field, you know, the pitch was shocking. Mm-hmm. I said to him, there's certain conditions I would certainly need, and that is you're going to have to get that pitch in order. Because you play football, which is the way I want it. Again, I'd be taking John Giles' advice. How can you play if you haven't got a pitch to play on? So very, very basic things. So I had a strong hand, pardon the pun, to say to Mickey Webb, chairman of Limerick at the time. And I then went about the football side of it, which I was actually going to be still part, because I was still capable of playing, certainly at the League of Ireland level. And I justified that by playing myself player manager. And Dave Mahidi, who I'm sure you know, Dave Mahidi, he'd been doing a temporary thing about keeping them fit and whatever, and he was very, very good. So I said to Jim, Dave, you keep going doing what you're doing, because I will need somebody to do that, to be the trainer or whatever. So that's, I didn't just go in and say, okay, I'm changing all staff, blah, 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 go. No, I thought, well, the John Giles way of doing it would be, hey, hold on a second, Dave Mahidi is a good help to you. So why do you want to get rid of him? You know, and that worked, you know, and it worked very well. And my starting career, my first season with Limerick it was amazing, fantastic. For me to win the league in my first season and to score in four goals against, in one particular game, Finn Harps, I think it was, mightn't have been. Anyway, I had a great start with Limerick that I immediately got the supporters on my side by the way we played and the way we scored goals and the way I scored goals. So from a personal player manager thing, it was hugely successful. Mm. Couldn't have asked for more. And behind it, getting advice, if there was anything at all about the management side of it, John was always available for a phone call. And I just said to him, again, no bullshit. I wouldn't try to gloss over something and say, oh, you know, well, I won't say that too strongly, blah, 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 blah. I'd say exactly what I thought, and he would come back with exactly what he thought was the right answer. So I know that I am talking a lot about John Giles, but he had a huge influence on me. And I'm sure, I mean, lots of other people, maybe they kind of went their own way and they didn't want to take John's advice. But I thought he was, again, from what you said earlier on about being analytical, which I was very analytical. If I had a fault, that was it. But then again, I didn't look at it as a fault. If you wanted to analyze something, and analyze it, I did always. Any problem within the game, or any person within the game, I'd analyze them and say, what's their thinking? Why are they saying that? Why are they doing that? I would analyze, and it worked. It always seemed to work. So,
talk to us about that league title winning season, because it's a real nip and tuck season between you and Dundalk. You won the league by a point on 47, Dundalk on 46. Did you have an inkling at some point in the season that the league title was on, or did you, as a manager, try and do what we kind of now see managers kind of do in the modern day, which is kind of like dampen it down a bit. Let's all just kind of keep calm and try and get about and do about our game plan.
Exactly. The way I felt about that was, again, I just said, there's absolutely no reason why we can't win the game next week, the next game we're playing. And that's exactly the way that I went about it. Only go as far as the next game. Again, saying this to the players, don't even think about winning a league. We have got Athlone Town next week away. We beat them, then we're in a good position. So just think of next Sunday. Now, that's all I want from you guys, is to put everything into next Sunday. And I would have the players, Johnny Walsh and Des Kennedy and whatever, I'd have them all focused on that to a point where, you know, it worked. So we went out and we just took the next game. We weren't going down and saying, if we win the next three games, you know, we could be in a good position. No. Just game by game. And it was the only way to go about it. And again, common sense way, and it worked. I mean, we did win the league, and I think, yeah, you said about was Athlone our main rivals then?
It was Dundalk.
Dundalk, of course. Yes, definitely Dundalk. That's it. Yeah. So I know that we had great battles with Dundalk, you know, but we took every game just one at a time, and that's what worked. And in fact, out of that, then obviously there was the vacancy came for Ireland, and I was asked would I like to consider doing a game, and they had some sort of a practice game or something against Argentina, was it? I think it was, I remember going for interviews up to Dublin to see that I was still going to be doing manager of Limerick, because playing for Ireland, it wasn't a matter of playing for Ireland, it was a matter of managing Ireland. And all helped by the way that my success had come at Limerick. Mm. So, and I've never forgot that. And I've always acknowledged the fact that Limerick played a huge part in me becoming Ireland manager.
And how did that come about, and how did it work? Because the idea of a manager kind of essentially managing the national team and a club team at the same time, in the modern sense, would be considered crazy, a bit bonkers. So how did it work, and how did you kind of deal with, I suppose, doubly the pressure of having to deal with a national team and your club side?
Well, I took the thing about, say, John Jones. Yeah, I took just every game one at a time, whatever game it was. So when they asked me would I consider doing the manager in Ireland, it wasn't a question of money, because they weren't paying anything. It was buttons. I mean, think John Jones was on 9,000 a year, you know. So, I mean, God, I know, okay, 9,000. But still, buttons compared to what now, I mean, cheapest you're talking about. Anyway, we won't even begin to go into it. But I just went about it one game at a time. And when I said, okay, I'll do this, and I didn't even ask the FAI about what was the money. I didn't even ask, because it wasn't a question of money. I wanted to see, could I marry the two? And I went to Limerick, and I told the manager, I said, listen, as far as I'm concerned, it would be a bonus for Limerick to have me as managing Ireland. It would not affect the work I'm given at Limerick. It would not affect where I live, which is Limerick. And that's it. And I went up to the FAI, and I remember sitting in this room, it was like a Oh, it was about a big room, and like it's a horseshoe, and I was in the middle, and being questions from every side, or whatever, about what would I do if as an international manager. And anyway, I must have said all the right things because I got the job. And I think I got the job starting on 12,000 a year, which was, I was quite happy. I never even asked what was involved, because no matter what, as far as I was concerned, if they said to me, we won't be paying you anything in the first year, I'd have said, that's okay. I would have. It's managing your country. That's, you know, so it was a totally different attitude. Like, I mean, John Giles being on 9,000, John was a big success with Leeds United. So did he need, no, he didn't. He didn't. And then did I? I mean, I was managing Limerick and I explained to them. So I wasn't pushed. I wasn't using Ireland as any sort of financial kind of, oh my God, it's going to make me rich. No, nothing like it. It was just the honour of playing for your country was the big, big thing. And then whatever would follow. So, okay, if you were whatever, I was 12,000 a year, and I finished up, I don't know what it was, years later, but it was never a question of money, never. Never an argument about it. Rightly so, as far as I'm concerned, because you get distracted. You accept it. If you accept it at the start that you're happy with this, and it'll do you, and you're going to be moving from that place to that place house-wise, if you got help, which I did, you got help with that. So you got enough. Mm. So you're never looking to make your country a good supplier of money for you internationally. I don't know, the attitude is not, it's a bit different these days, I would think, particularly when it's now foreign players. It's not foreign managers. Mm. Foreign managers and not Irish managers, which is disappointing. I do find that very disappointing that we can't find an Irish person to manage our own country. They find that very, very disappointing and something that shouldn't happen. So, but anyway, it does.
Well, we might have one in a couple of years' time, maybe Damien Duff
something like that. Exactly. You know what
I
mean? Exactly.
So, but I wanted to bring you back. I'll get down to the Ireland's management, but I just want to ask you a quick, maybe not so quick, but you won the league with Limerick, but you got an incredibly lucrative tie out of it in the end, which was with Real Madrid. Real Madrid in any decade is probably an extraordinary draw. What did you feel like when you knew that Real Madrid was the team that you would have to play against in the European Cup?
Oh, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. You know, the attitude that I wanted to put across was, you know, and I went to see them. I went to see them play. And I thought, well, and when I went to see them, I wanted to see their training ground and I wanted to see all the things. So what I made sure that I did was I would be as professional as possible and show our lads that once we went to the pitch and took them on, it was 11 against 11. And we would just go 11 against 11 and blah, blah, blah. And we'd do all the things we would make sure, insist on being allowed to train on Real Madrid pitch the night before, which was for us, League of Ireland, blah, blah, blah. You know, they were inclined to say, oh, no, you can do, we use our training grounds. And I said, no, we will not. We will use the ground we're playing on. We're entitled to it, which we were. We could have put an objection into UEFA if they said, no, you can't do that. I would have definitely, and I told them that. I said, I would be complaining if you don't allow us to train, because it's part of the whole regulations of that you must be allowed to train at least once before the big game. So all our players, in other words, I impressed upon our team, our Limerick lads, who had by this stage now, I mean, they had won a league and they'd responded to me. And these are all part-time players. They responded to me and I'd got an awful lot out of them. And here they are playing against Real Madrid and they were quite happy and were quite content. When they went on that pitch to play against Real Madrid, they weren't worried about, you know. I've insisted that you just take every single thing on the pitch that happens. Say, okay, I made a mistake there. Don't make it again. So it's still the same game of football. There's just one ball there. There's 11 against 11. So keep it as simple as possible. So I made it that way, type of thing. And it was great to be able to do that. Now, we lost the game 4-1, I think it was. I'm not quite sure.
The second leg you lost 5-1, but you lost 2-1 in the first leg up in Dublin. Yeah.
In Dublin, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, no, that was it. So, I mean, that was the away game. We played Dublin first, I think, didn't we?
Yes, did we? Yeah, that was the first game. Yeah, yeah. And then you went away to Riyadh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, what I said about the pitch and all that was about Lansdowne Road as well. I mean, the players were very much aware of this, blah, blah, blah. And then when we went to Madrid, that's when I insisted that we have our training session. What I wanted to do was, I knew that realistically, we had not got a chance of putting Real Madrid out of the European Cup. I knew that. And so, but that was not being defeatist. I never said it to the players. What I said to the players is, you are going to go and play as best as you can. The same way that you play every week for Limerick, you're going to bring that into your game against them. And you're going to do it in a lovely pitch in Dublin, which we've worked on, and we've got the pitch lovely and level. And you're going to do it in Real Madrid, in their stadium, which is, I mean, a great honour to be able to say that you played in that stadium. But you're going to enjoy it. And you're going to give every effort, put everything into it, without losing any of the skills that you obviously have as players. In other words, you will not be overawed at all. And that was the way I went about the management, and it worked. We knew that we weren't going to. We worked in so much as that those players, Limerick players, they right now, they still remember that like as if it was yesterday. Mm. It did so much for them. I mean, Des Kennedy, for instance, and he scored in Dublin, and he scored out there.
Yeah, took the lead so with Des, his goal.
Well, Des still is talk. Des is asked to do an awful lot of talking after doing a speech, whatever. And it's a laugh, actually, because he always talks about his goals against Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. It's like a topic for him, which has become funny for us because he said, oh, geez, we got Des coming to the flipping lunch that we're doing. So we'll hear more about his goals against Real Madrid. But anyway, that was all a very enjoyable part of it. But it's all, I mean, looking back on it, and I look back and say, okay, fine. The influences of the way I went about my career was, don't be a bullshitter. If you know something, make it better. If you don't know it, say that you don't know it, but don't bullshit. And I've always followed that kind of line of teaching. And it's been, and it's not just football. You can apply it to anything. You know, you can take it outside your, anything. Mm. And you can say, look, don't be a bullshitter. What's the point in bullshitting and saying something that you're not capable of doing and you don't understand yourself? What's the point? So I always had that kind of commonsensical attitude about life generally. And this to me is something that sport has been a huge help and can be to anybody who wants to go about it the right way. And it gives anybody who is going about it the right way a lovely, shall we say, background and a strong character. You know, you will have a strong character if you do the right things, and because sport is such that there's no excuses and there's no easy road. Every road is a hard road. Hmm. You want to make it easier, you've got to really put the work into it. And that's what life is about too. So, I mean, sport is more than sport for me. It has been a great educational part of my life. Never mind the fact that, okay, you go and you get a literary education, that's good. But the education you get from sport, and that I certainly got, i.e. as a player and as a manager, has been immense.
Yeah. And speaking of that as well, I mean, in terms of managing Ireland, managing your country as well, was it a case of being so close yet so far away in terms of that? We came agonizingly close to qualifying, and you could argue it kind of got taken away from you as well. So how do you explain to us a little bit about managing Ireland, and I suppose that campaign that brought us so close to qualify.
That was a real sickener, is the best way I can put it, Robbie, because Nazaré is the man that we're talking about. He was a referee, a Portuguese referee, who robbed us against Belgium. And in that campaign, we scored a perfectly good goal with Frank Stapleton. It was a Liam Brady, Stapleton, Arsenal, little idea between them type of thing. Brady would run up, pretend to hit it, then he'd come back, and then he'd turn quick, and then Staple would have pretended to make a run, but then he would make the run. Anyway, it was perfectly, and Stapleton scored a great goal. But this referee gave no reason whatsoever. He disallowed it. And then about 5 minutes from the end of the game, didn't he give a penalty against us, whatever, saying the goalkeeper pushed the fellow, whatever. And it was ridiculous. It was just an absolute nonsense. So we'd heard about this referee, whatever. And I'll never forget, in Belgium, I went to him after the game and I said, "You are a disgrace. You have robbed us. You have taken money. You have been bribed." Now, he should have red carded me. He should have reported me. He just went, "Go away." I said, "You're a thief. You're a crook. You're a fucking crook, you are. We heard bad things about you, but my God Almighty, now this is proof." It was proven afterwards. Took a few years, but it was proven afterwards that he had taken money, that he was bribed by the gambler men. He was bribed because Belgium had to win the game. They had to win the game. And he got huge money to make sure they did. And we were the sufferers of that. Mm. And that, I never forgot that. And I'll never forgive that man either. I don't know if he's dead or what now. But it really was a sickness, because that was a real great chance for us to qualify for the 82 World Cup. It was a great opportunity. And all our players, I mean, they were all really in the prime. They really were top class, all in their prime. And of course, they had to wait for Jack to come along to get any success type of thing, which again, you're talking about the luck of the draw. I mean, Jack got it with Scotland going out to Bulgaria or Romania or somebody like that anyway, and beating them. And of course, that was the big turning point for Ireland's qualifying. Anyway, that's a different story.
And when you look on that, because you're so close to, I suppose, that era of Jack Charlton beginning as well, do you look at that and you go, "Geez, you know, if only I had done this, if only I had done that, it might have been me, it might have been us going to major championships," or do you kind of separate it and say, you know, this was the hand I was kind of dealt, and that's the way you just got to deal with it?
To answer your question, how did I deal with it? I dealt with it the way that I've told you. I dealt with stuff that I learned. That stuff that I learned was, try your best. You've got to try your best. And if you know that you did your best and it didn't work out, well, then that's okay. Well, that's exactly the attitude I took towards that. Did you do your best? Did you try your best around it? Yes, I did. Did you, even down to the point of attacking the bloody referee and accusing him and hoping that UEFA, who, by the way, UEFA turned out to be gangsters as well, but a lot of the people there. So, no, I have no regrets about the way I went about it. I don't think I would have had to be turned out to be a dishonest type of person for me to be able to say that's what you need to be successful. And I just didn't have it. I'm not blowing my own trumpet, but I'm just saying to things as they are. I never, ever would go down the road of cheating to achieve something in sport. Never. And I never did. I never did. You can say, "Oh, you're a bloody idiot. I mean, you have to cheat to flip and win." No, you don't. No, you don't. If you're good enough, you can do it. And it's only a short-term thing if you're cheating. If you're cheating and to get just short-term thing, okay, you might make some money, whatever. But then, as far as I'm concerned, you're that type of person, so something else will go wrong in your life and then you'll be the loser. And I'm quite happy to be able to say that I've had a good life. I've had a very good life from football. It's helped me. It's had its ups and its downs, that's for sure. But I've always gone through it with the attitudes that I've saying to you that I learned over the years. And I learn I did from other people. i.e. the biggest learner I learned from was John Giles. A lot of respect for the man, really have.
Fantastic. And what happens then, I suppose, during that period as well, is, am I right in saying you manage out in Saudi Arabia too with Al Tawan and before you get to Huddersfield? What was that kind of Saudi Arabia experience like? Was it a strange experience?
It was a real, I'd never go through it again. I mean, even then, I was told, because I'd actually financially, I was struggling. I had a sports shop in Dublin, whatever, and it wasn't doing particularly well or whatever. And everything has gone wrong with my life, whatever. So I was offered this situation in Saudi, and 1 year tax-free would get me, it was huge money. I can't remember, it was like 40,000 or something. So I went out there and did it. And I've no regrets that I did do it, but I would never do it again unless I had to, out of desperation, because I did not like that country. And I still to this day think there's a very hypocritical, very, very hypocritical, attitude out there, about, everything about the way they used to treat women was shocking, shocking, and still is as far as I'm concerned. So I won't talk too much about it other than to say I'd like to think that I'd never have to go back to Saudi Arabia. Never. No.
So.
And anybody who goes out there to work, I would just say to them, well, I'm sure that it's because they have to.
You managed with Huddersfield. You were there for 4 or 5 seasons. What brought you to Huddersfield? And I suppose what was your experience there?
I suppose going back to the year that I came to Huddersfield, it was more a question of there wasn't a vacancy there, and my managerial background with Ireland was the big key for me when I did apply for the position as Huddersfield. I still had my house in Limerick, and I had 2 boys born at this stage, Gary and Warren, and I thought, well, okay, I'll put my name forward for the Huddersfield job because I was available. I think this was after Saudi and whatever. I wasn't going to go back there. So being manager of Ireland was a huge bonus for me, looking back on it. And plus, and I forget the board of Huddersfield Town, they were impressed about the fact that I was manager of Ireland. I was going to stand to them. And I said to them, well, it will.
So, all the things that I've said to you about previous experience and learning curve and all that, I thought, I'm going to apply to Huddersfield Town. And I enjoyed it there. And I was disappointed I never got them promoted. Huddersfield, unfortunately, they were a selling club. They weren't a buying club. And I couldn't buy any players. So, one of my best players, I can't remember, I had to sell him. They said to me, we have to sell that player because I think we found it was Swansea at the time. I can't remember his name. But it was a real testing thing for me. I did enjoy my time at Huddersfield, and I had a nice property there, a nice house, small one in a nice area. And I enjoyed it. My sons as well were all, they were happy about finishing off their. My eldest son, the one who's a pilot now, he had got a scholarship to, I think it was British Airways, so it worked out fine. It finished up okay, being manager of Huddersfield. I was disappointed with the board at Huddersfield in so much as that they never contributed anything towards wanting to get a better team or anything like that. They never did. I just wanted somebody with a magic wand to get the players that they had. But some of the players just weren't good enough, And I was aware of that. I was aware of it after a fairly short time, because there's nothing else.
over my career, I could judge if a player was going to be good enough for a certain standard, or could you improve him? Now, okay, I tried to improve some of these, and I did one or two of them, but then there were some that just weren't improvable, not to the standard that we wanted. So,
how do you deal with that as a manager? Because you obviously want to make a team better, but you seem to have a board, etc., that just doesn't seem to want to be in that kind of space with you. So, how do you deal with that as a manager? Because you want to be successful, but yet on the other hand, you kind of need a bit of money to make it as successful as you want. But if you're not getting it, you get this.
How do you deal with difficulty? Once you accept that that's the case, then it is with difficulty. Because you're talking about trying to do something that's basically impossible. And it can be a very frustrating thing. I mean, you can go to your board as much as you like. And if they say, no, we'll have to sell some players if you want to get another player in, we'll have to sell some players. So you're weakening your side because the seller player has to be one of your better players. So that was a very frustrating time for me at Huddersfield. Looking back on it, I enjoyed living there, and I've still got some very good friends, and I would go and visit them still even, but I would never go near Huddersfield Town, the board and whatever, the people involved in football, because they wanted something for nothing. You know, you were like you were a flipping wizard. You come in and you wave your wand and that's it. You're going to be a good team. No, it doesn't work like that. So even explaining to them that our players are not good enough to get out of that division, so we're not good enough to stay at this kind of level. So very frustrating time. That's a very frustrating time. And of course, it was coming to the end of my career.
Yeah, and on that as well, you found yourself back out in South Africa again in 93 with AmaZulu. What brought you back out there? Was it just your brother still out there, or did you just you love the country, you love being there, so you gave it a go? Or what brought you out there?
I love the country. Yes, and my brother was still there. He was in Durban, and I loved the country, and I wanted to make a career out of and get something back. So getting something back would be being treated well in South Africa. I mean, apartheid was kind of gone away. And it was just, it is a beautiful country. And my daughter, she lives in Johannesburg. She comes here. She visits me the odd time. I mean, we actually speak once a week, certainly once a fortnight. She's a very, very qualified, degreed lady. She's 40 years of age. She was born in 94. So I mean, it was just part of living and all the things that happened. I mean, whenever I kind of made my decisions, it was Huddersfield Town. Swindon Town. I go through the boards. You're making the decision. You're not making rash decisions. You're making decisions at the time that seem to be the best one. And that seemed to be the case with South Africa. I love the country. I think the country, unfortunately, has had its problems, big problems, within which it has rectified up to a degree, to a very large degree. You still would have attitudes about look down their noses at everybody type of thing. Never mind just the coloured people. But I did. I enjoyed the whole country. I mean, South Africa is such a big country. You can go somewhere into one of the parks and you can get into some bungalow type thing and you can go off and see elephants live and hippopotamuses live, They don't want to go near them, but to see these situations, I mean, it's incredible. I really enjoyed South Africa. Mm.
You come back then to manage Shelburne for a season, a while, etc. What does something happen at Shelburne where you, because you didn't manage after that, so did something happen at Shelburne, or did something happen in yourself where you decided that this managerial era of football had to come to an end?
No, I'd said I'm only just doing a temporary job just to get the medal. It was just a temporary job that I said I was going to do. It was going to be no long-time thing at all because I'd done my bit. And I just wanted to settle down and deal, obviously, with the DSAI. And just career guidance became my thing. I mean, I did not want to stay with the DSAI. And doing career guidance, I meeting the young kids who were going to England and advising them on all the different problems and different this and that, the help you can get. And using my experience over the years to say to the FAI, but there is a position for this, and they said, yes, there is, and we'll take you up. Mm. And it is. So that's what that was about. So I wasn't going to be directly involved with the actual management side or coaching side of football.
Talk to us a little bit about that career guidance type of thing. The things that had happened to you in your own life, the death of your father when you were quite young, etc. Is this what kind of brought you into this position too? That you wanted to give these young people, I suppose, the guidance and etc. that they kind of need in your life when those kind of things might happen.
I was when, shall we say, the experiences I went through were quite a lot. I mean, quite a lot. Mm. For me to have the right to be able to explain to youngsters, look, it's not all glory, it's not all this and that. So here's the reality of it. So I could give them the real story and just say to them, no, I'm not going to say to you, look, you can't go. Because if you're good enough, fine, you will go. But I mean, the career guidance that I was involved in is okay, saying, and then by being practical about it and saying, okay, that you can go to a school there in that area. I would have the knowledge of, say, where it was, say, Portsmouth, for instance. Mm. And I say, you can go on to university there. And you are an intelligent lad. So why use football to help yourself? That's what I did. Mm. So you gave the advice that you would have liked when you were going through it. Once you did that, then there was a role for you. And the FAI were fully aware of that and appreciated it until Delaney came into the whole situation and then messed the whole thing up. Messed everybody up. But it was a position that I was proud to be able to say that I fulfilled. And it was a big help to an awful lot of youngsters who, over the years since, have come back to me and say, you know, your advice was brilliant. You know, it was great, blah, blah, blah. And it's nice when you get the feedback from that. Like, I mean, I never got one feedback to say, Jesus, what you said is a load of nonsense. You didn't know what you were talking about. No, I never got one negative. Yeah, never.
And is that something, I suppose, that we often forget in football as well, that, you know, quite a lot of youngsters don't make it in football as a career in terms of, you know, longevity, etc., and doing it as a professional contracted sport, and that they need this kind of thing where they need to have it, the education, like yourself, etc. They need to understand that, you know, the majority of you aren't going to make it, so you need something, you need a backup, you need some kind of position where you are that you can be fruitful in life.
Well, yeah, you've got to get that across. And you've got to get it across in a very sensible way. And to have the experience to be able to say, this is exactly what happens, you know, and here's the numbers about it. Like, I mean, I'm not saying to you, you know, you're not going to be a success. The biggest one to help you to be a success is you, nobody else. If you are driven, and you have to be really, really driven, then you can be a success. Because you have the skills. But I mean, to get them to actually go and do that, an awful lot would just say, oh God, no, I didn't think it was going to be this. And once that comes into your head, forget it. And unfortunately, that is the case in a lot of the instances that I see today. I mean, I'm not doing any of that now, it's 18 years of age. Mm. We're new next year. But it's been, I mean, I've always kind of put across the kids exactly what I went through. So, I mean, exactly all the things that I've said to you about, there you are, use that. I'll give the advice. You were a player. Before you were a player, what were you? Yeah, okay, fine. You might have been bullied by the bully curtain, whatever, because you're a good Gaelic footballer as well. And then you were, you know, in club football, what happened there? Junior club football. And then in senior, in professional football, what happened there? And then, okay, when you gave up playing because your body wouldn't do it for you anymore, what happened then? Yeah, what happened then when you were assistant manager? What happens when you were a manager? And it's all these things are huge educations all the time. Every one of them you can learn from. And they're all practical. And if you have all that stored, which I'd like to think that I have near enough, proven by the fact that going through this with you is maybe saying that. So it's just doing all the things that you, and saying all the things that you went through. And therefore, you know, nobody would ever call you a bullshit.
And talking about the no bullshit, it probably brings me on to my final question, which is, how would you summarize your footballing life, and how would you describe it in your own words?
I would say that I consider myself one of the luckiest people alive. I am still around. I'm a year away from 80 years of age. Why? Because of football. My body was, every day I had to be fit as a player. I had to be fit. When I finished playing, I had to keep other players fit, which meant that I was keeping myself fit as well, basically. So all through my life as a footballer, I was doing all these things and helping other people, an awful lot of people, of young people. And it gave me great mental appreciation of everything. So if I look back on my career, I think I am very, very lucky. I think that I have done so much to help other people. And I don't say that in any arrogant, big-headed way. I have passed on what was given to me. And what was given to me was opportunities, great opportunities, at a time when they were difficult to be given. I'm going back to the 60s, the 70s, whatever. And just the whole drive to say, well, if you want to do something, don't just expect it to be handed to you on a plate. You have to work for it. Now, that doesn't apply in sport just at all. It applies in everything. Don't expect things for nothing. And I think an awful lot of our younger world today, they might have the wrong attitude. And I think that's where sport is a great education. It really is a great educational way of life, if you like. It can become very, very hard to actually be a success in sport. And to be a success in sport, you have to have, first of all, the natural ability. But the natural ability is nothing without the drive. You have to have that. And I would say that about anything. Any person that wants to be anything, have they got the natural ability to be it? You know, in other words, he wants to be a lawyer? Does he know enough about the legal scene? Does he read enough? Has he got the way of life to become that? And then will he work at it? You know, and that's what you apply. Never, ever think it's going to be handed to you. Just work at it and it'll happen.
Absolutely fantastic. A great advice to take in any aspect of life. Owen Hann, thank you very much for the time that you've given us today. It's been an extraordinary journey, both from yourself and your career, but also from you as well. And we really appreciate you giving us the time on the podcast and giving us an insight into, as you say, what's driven you throughout your career and throughout your life as well. So thank you very much for that. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to Owen Hann for his wonderful candor as he took us through the journey of his footballing life. We'll have more guests with us in the coming weeks to tell us about their footballing life, so stick with us for those. And you can also do that by subscribing to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, and Amazon Music, as well as a host of other platforms too. Share the show on your social media platforms to help others learn more about the history and heritage of Irish football. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League club. It's our heritage. It's our game. Until then, bye for now.